Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you by our listener-supported community radio station, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois at 90.1 FM and webcast live worldwide at WEFT.org. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Gus with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois' Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois' Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channingbury Foundation, 1209 West Oregon, Urbana. For more information, visit www.centralillinoisjobswithjustice.org. Programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. The Graduate Employees Organization Union, GEO, at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WEFT Community Radio.
Okay, thank you, Gus. And I guess we got a very special guest here in the studio that we're going to introduce to you here momentarily. But first, we got some news stories. Real quick, Gus, I just wanted to throw in something I just heard the other day is that the local Clifford and Jacobs lockout heard that the company's trying to challenge their unemployment benefits because under Illinois law, if you go out on strike, you're not eligible for unemployment. But if you're locked out by the company, you are eligible for unemployment benefits, just as if you were laid off.
Exactly. Yeah, that's what's happening right now. The negotiations started back up on October 13th, but there's been a stalemate. The workers are trying to negotiate a fair contract, and of course the bosses are fighting them as usual.
Yeah.
So what happened is that they're trying to take away their unemployment as being locked out workers, but of course we know that that should not go through.
Mm-hmm.
So the workers are fighting that right now. The union reps are at work right now trying to get that fixed. But the thing is that the 24-hour informational picket has been going on continuously, and what they need right now is firewood and food to supplement what they're doing. So they're going to be out there all day and night. So if you have any free time, please go out there and just say hello to them, bring them some firewood, whatever you can do, because this is a human rights crisis right now that's actually reverberating around the country, where you have big government and companies taking advantage of workers. I mean, this is a culture that's existing right now.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to break that. We need some solidarity. So if you got some time, please.
Okay, I heard there was a really good turnout at the rally rally for those workers on Tuesday. I heard State Representative Carol Ammons and State Senator Scott Bennett even made an appearance there.
Yeah, they went out there, but the thing that really got me really excited was there were so many different, there was a diverse group of people there. You had community members, you had graduate students, you had undergraduate students, you had professors, you had church members, and you had other union workers out there. Matt Kelly, AFL president, was there. So, I mean, all these different groups were out there in solidarity for the workers there. And, I mean, that was the biggest thing that kind of kept the worker spirit going throughout this mess, is the community always came out there and stayed with them. I mean, they've been doing this since September, I believe, 28th. It's the middle of October. It's going almost into a month that they've been out there 24 hours a day, and we've had that solidarity. And that's what's really powerful.
Indeed.
We just got to keep it going.
Indeed. Okay, so what did you find interesting this week in the news?
Well, everybody by now is used to my big updates on the UAW and Fiat Chrysler contract negotiations, and that our favorite non-union person, Dennis Williams, continues to hurt the workers. But now we're actually starting to break down the contract, and there are some things in it that are really going to be shocking to some people who think that unions are supposed to be for people. So as workers read through the contents of the second proposed agreement between the UAW and Fiat Chrysler, they are finding more and more of things they don't like. And opposition to the second contract is growing, which means the UAW and the corporate alliance are now getting really, really nervous. The Detroit Free Press published an article on Friday afternoon noting warily that, quote, many workers remain unhappy and ratification is far from certain. On the chances of ratification, the corporate newspaper writes, this is a tough call because hundreds of workers continue to express anger and frustration over wage progression and other issues. Workers are justifiably opposed to the contract, not only because of the long wage progression for second-tier workers, but also because it perpetuates the two-tier system as a whole, maintains the alternative work schedule, does not include cost of living adjustments, includes harsh punishments on attendance, and includes many other anti-worker provisions. In recent days, the revelation that the contract allows the company to double the number of temporary workers has provoked widespread outrage. With the collaboration of the UAW, Dennis Williams, the company has been systematically expanding its use of temp workers, effectively transforming them into a third, even lower paid tier. So this is something that's really getting to the point to where Dennis Williams is trying to exclude the workers from even their own position in labor now.
Yes.
I mean, they're bringing in temp workers, and we know what the next step is after that.
Yeah, this is just, you know, unfortunately, this has been going on now for several decades where not all, but there's been several U.S. unions that have basically, instead of representing their members who pay their salaries, they're actually collaborating with the employers. I mean, and of course the workers, are getting the brunt end of the deal here.
Yeah, Dave. Well, where I live, there are many Caterpillar workers in that area, and most of them from at least from the Boomer generation had been able to build a pretty good middle income lifestyle.
Yeah.
With decent houses, good vacations, great medical care, able to pay the bills except for the occasional really bad time like around 1980, that recession.
Yeah.
I saw Caterpillar workers walking beans.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, folks, walking beans is when you go out and get the weeds out of the beans by hand. I've found a lot of people around here don't even realize that anymore, Dave. But it's just, and that's going away. It's being terribly eroded, and the union's not really standing up to do anything about it.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, being in the building trades like you and I, with the carpenters, my union and old union and your laborers, I mean, it's, a similar phenomena where it should be called, carpenters local 44, should be contractors local 44.
Well, human resources.
Yeah.
Local.
And that's the thing is, I always said when we had our rank and file nationwide rebellion in the carpenters is that the carpenters used to be a grand tradition of unionism, going back, over 100 years, but that, recent years, through various legal mechanisms and disenfranchisement of the rank and file, that in fact, it's become a labor ready corporation pretending to be a union.
Yeah.
In fact, when your members can't vote on contracts, when they can't vote for their representation, then you don't know, that's no longer a union.
Right, yeah, and we don't have any of that.
Yeah.
The laborers don't, for sure.
Yeah. So, anyway, got an interesting kind of national slash Illinois slash local news story here. You've been hearing on that I've been talking about this upcoming single-payer Medicare for All national conference in Chicago, which is coming up here in 2 weeks, and Labor Campaign for Single Payer is one of the many coalitions involved in that kind of joint conference, along with Physicians for a National Health Plan and single-payer states. And locally, two unions came on board to endorse not only the national single-payer bill, House Resolution 676, but also the Illinois equivalent, and also to endorse the upcoming conference. One of them, of course, is the Graduate Employees Union here, thanks to Gus. And Gus is going to have a little personal statement he might want to read on the show sometime here in a couple of weeks about that. Now, the other union is the Champaign, Illinois Education Support Staff Union, affiliated with the IEA, Illinois Education Association. One of the members they're sending there to represent them is executive board member named Heidi Johnson. And when they asked her statement of why her union wanted to endorse, this is her quoted statements. As an elected union officer, I see how the health care benefits for our members is becoming harder and harder to get during our negotiations, said Johnson. I'm afraid that in the near future, it will become even worse, she said, and explained why the union took this action for single payer. I am from Germany originally, so I'm very familiar with single payer health care system, and unfortunately had to live under this American-style corporate system for many years. Believe me, this health care system in the U.S. is horrible, and I believe that this country could do so much better. The union that she represents has 400 members, including secretaries, custodians, bus drivers, food service workers, maintenance, and teachers aides. And that's hopefully we're going to get a lot more individual unions on board here in the state of Illinois over time. And the more people that get involved, the sooner we're going to be able to actually have a civilized healthcare system in this country.
Oh man! Well, you remember my story from last week about the $500 tube of skin ointment.
Yes,
that
incredible. Okay, let's see. Bill, do you have any news stories?
No, nothing here. I'm reading about Dr. Gill, though.
Okay, well, we're going to be talking about that real quick.
That's right.
Okay, Angela, anything happened this week that you'd like to talk about?
Well, I just wanted to talk about the healthcare as well.
Uh-huh.
Me and my son, we're on Health Alliance.
Okay.
But we took too long for the recertification on changing his doctor or just letting him know who we wanted. So they switched them to a Molina healthcare. So Molina does not accept, you can't go to Walgreens like we have been. Also, his doctors at Carl don't accept Molina. So ends up, I had to switch. I called and I gave them the information and let them know what happened. So they switched him back, but it'll be back on November 1st. So he has to wait till then because he's taking a medicine for seizures, right? And I think they should lower the dose, but they won't do anything about this.
You know, that's the problem. That's the problem with this whole, corporate, private health insurance system in this country is that, you're basically a victim of them. And just for clarity, a single payer system would institute, care by expanding, medical care by improving, Medicare for everybody. Every person for all necessary medical care, would be included, including, prescription drugs, hospital, surgical, outpatient services, primary care, emergency services, dental, and hearing, and there would be no, end all deductibles and co-pays. It would save hundreds of billions annually in the country, and not to mention that, there would be no restricted, networks of service. In other words, saying you can only go to this doctor and you can only go to this hospital. Otherwise, if you don't, you got to pay like 60% of the bill. And this is the real problem, especially if you're traveling out of town. What are you going to do? Get MapQuest out, map your route, and see which hospitals along that route will take. Hopefully, if you get in a car accident, you're conscious to tell the medical emergency personnel, don't take me to the nearest hospital. Take me to the one 10 miles further down the road because I'll be covered. I mean, this is insane. This is really insane. So, thanks for sharing that, Angela. Because you know what, it seems like. everybody, if they don't have direct problems with the healthcare system of the country, knows somebody that has current or past problems. But anyway, Gus, what else has been happening?
Well, everybody's been talking a lot about the Democratic primary debate.
Oh, yes.
We're going to get into that and the false socialism of Bernie Sanders in a minute. But we're going to actually – the story that's not getting a lot of press right now is what's been happening with the drone program in the U.S., especially after the hospital massacre that was created and enforced by the president and the federal government. There's been some documents that have been released that talk about what's been going on with the drones. Secret U.S. government documents published this week by The Intercept have shed new light on the institutionalization of the American government's international drone murder operation. The documents, a series of secret Pentagon briefing slides and internal reports outlining details of their drone killing programs in Africa and the Middle East, were leaked to The Intercept by an anonymous source within the intelligence community who has worked on drone killing operations. Under the guise of the, quote, war on terror that began in 2001, two separate but parallel drone assassination operations, one overseen by the Pentagon and the other by, of course, the CIA, have been developed to carry out regular drone strikes in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, and Iraq. These operations have now been extended to Syria. One selection of documents given to The Intercept provides a summary of a military campaign in Afghanistan codenamed Operation Haymaker, carried out in Kunar and Nuristan provinces between January 2012 and 2013, that highlights the chaos and the death produced by drone assassination attempts. So what we actually are seeing is that there is some type of coordination, and many of the people in the report puts out that, and this is the scary part. The internal documents reveal that during a 5-month period, 90% of those people killed by drone strikes in the operation were not direct targets. Out of the 235 people killed in Operation Haymaker, only 35 were direct targets. The other 200 were innocent bystanders. The operation had targeted not only alleged members of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, but also members of local Salafist militia groups that were actively resisting the U.S. occupation. The number of civilians and other unintended targets killed in drone strikes over the last decade has not impacted the rapid growth of the bureaucratic mechanism used to target and kill. Over the next 4 years, the military is planning to expand its drone capability by 50%.
Wow.
So again, there's a correlation. You've noticed that there's been a rise in drone killings to the rise in mass killings in America, to where it's every 64 days that somebody kills 4 people or more in the United States. These drones are killing over 200 people that are innocent bystanders, and the numbers are rising. So we have to make sure that when we analyze violence in America, we analyze it within a global context, because these things correlate.
Oh, indeed.
Violence is now a part of what Eisenhower was talking about with the military industrial complex. You're taking something that's foundational in American history going back to the 1600s, and you're now expanding it and using capitalism to supplant it. I mean, this is a scary thing that's happening right now.
Indeed. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break, and we're right back and introduce our very special guest here in the studio listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back.
Come on,
Okay, that was Ann Feeney, National Healthcare Now. And now I'd like to introduce our very special guest, David Gill. Welcome to the World Labor Hour.
Thanks for having me here, David. I appreciate it.
Okay, tell the listeners a little bit about yourself, those who don't know you.
I live in Bloomington, Illinois, and I'm a physician by training. I'm a full-time physician. I'm board certified in both family practice and emergency medicine. I've been working in the emergency room full-time for about 15 or 16 years, and I'm running for Congress in 2016 as an independent. I've run in the past. I've been a Democrat all my life until recent months. I ran as a Democrat in the old Illinois 15 three times back in the first decade of this century, back in 2004, 2006, and 2010. And I wasn't necessarily running to win during those elections. The district that I was running in was a solid 75% Republican district. And I was a believer, though, that people need to have their voices heard. And so I wanted to stand up for certain principles, certain populist principles with those elections, and did reasonably well. But obviously it was difficult. And I thought that I was done with electoral politics then. I really have no background in that field, being a doctor. And with redistricting, though, after the 2010 census, a new Illinois 13 got created that was somewhat more balanced than the old Illinois 15. And so I threw my hat in the ring one more time and had to take on the Democratic Party in the primary for the 2012 election. They had their pro-corporate candidate, and we got outspent 5-1, but got out there and talked with a lot of people and let it be known the things that I believe in, and we pulled off an upset in the primary and moved on into the general election.
Yeah, something interesting happened in the primary, if I'm not mistaken, was that on election night, all of a sudden down in Edwardsville area where your opponent was from, all of a sudden they said that there was some so-called election irregularities, and they held up the announcing the official winner, didn't they?
Yeah, it took about until 3 or 4 in the morning to finally get declared the winner of that primary election.
So, okay.
I don't know what that funny business was,
but yeah.
I know that the Democratic Party did not want me representing them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't like anybody standing up, speaking truth to their power. And so, I moved on into the general, and it was very difficult. The Democratic Party did not want to embrace someone with my views.
Now, we're talking about mainly the DNC, the National Democratic
Yeah, the
National
Democratic
Committee.
Congressional Campaign Committee, the
okay.
DCCC,
and
the DNC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And after several months, they kind of grudgingly got behind my campaign, if you will. They put a lot of negative TV commercials on the air about my opponent, Representative Rodney Davis. And at the end of the day, we got outspent substantially still and almost pulled off the upset. It's people think that it's a balanced district. It's not. President Obama lost Illinois 13 back in 2012, and I lost in the second closest of the 435 U.S. House races that year by 0.3% of the vote. And my view is that I would have won had there not been an independent that year.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to get on as an independent onto the ballot in the first election after redistricting, and there was an independent there who was echoing all of my views on climate change and campaign finance reform and single-payer health care and gay marriage and a woman's right to manage her own body. It was like running against myself and against Rodney Davis, and that guy pulled 7%. And so those progressive views actually won the day by 7 percentage points in this district.
Mm-hmm.
And still, in spite of that, in spite of this relative success that I achieved back in 2012, the Democratic Party had no interest in me running again and pushed me to the sidelines. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. So in 2014, I let them go ahead with their next pro-corporate candidate who proceeded to get
Ann
slammed.
Kallas, yes.
Yeah, Ann Kallas mm-hmm. lost by 60 times the margin by which I lost.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Durbin lost this district by 20 times what I lost it by in 2014. It's not an easy district.
Mm-hmm.
Having a D after your name is a handicap. And so I thought that perhaps after they saw Ann Kallas lose by 60 times what I lost by, that they could maybe stop embracing the corporations that fund them to such an extent that they could let go of that a little bit and say, you know what, this man's with us on 75-80% of things, and he succeeds. We now recognize the success that he achieved back in 2012. But no, it's
sounds like corporate money trumps principles.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and so they don't want me around, and I continue to see people suffering and hurting, and so I've decided to run as an independent. We've done polling that shows that this can be done. This
mm-hmm.
won't be 7% like that independent guy back in 2012. This will be a very competitive race, and we're really excited about it.
Yeah, you know the 80-20 rule.
What's that?
The 80-20 rule, like 80% isn't really that much of something a lot of times, but there's that 20% that's really important.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you talk about single payer. You talk about emphasizing the importance of fighting back against climate change, and you're going to turn off the people at the highest levels of the Democratic Party.
But they don't care if you talk about gay marriage, and they really don't care what color people are anymore, you know, and things like that. You can have that. Abortion, you know, we don't care
gun
about
control,
that.
You know,
we can afford to send our people to Europe or somewhere for abortions if we have to.
It's issues that involve dollars.
Yes. Now, you know, it's interesting what you're saying is that obviously you've tapped into some people that either don't vote or who would normally vote Republican that would want to support you on because of certain issues that kind of cut through certain partisan identity politics labels.
Exactly, David. You know, when we do the polling, there's 15 to 20% of Republicans who say, I'd rather have independent David Gill than Republican Rodney Davis. And I think that was pivotal to my nearly pulling off the upset back in 2012. You know, I work with a bunch of Republicans in hospitals, and I know Republicans, and there are many issues on which I disagree with them. But at the end of the day, I think they're looking for integrity, and I think they're looking for character. And when I talk about the fact that we've all been cheated for the last 30 to 40 years, that type of talk resonates even amongst people who might disagree with me on things like gay marriage.
Yeah. I think the comedian Lewis Black had said something in one of his skits about, you know, people who say they're staunch Democrats or staunch Republicans are seeing something that isn't there. That's called delusional. Of course, I can't deliver like Lewis Black can, but, you know, I think there's a lot of truth in that, is that there's a lot of people that the only reason they vote straight Democratic or straight Republican is because they've somehow been convinced, probably from a very young age, probably what their parents did and stuff, that this is the best, in their best interest. When a lot of these people, are working class, most of them are working class people that oftentimes are voting against their own, interests.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, Dave, since the late 60s, we've seen the rise of the independent voter, you know, that doesn't ally with either party, and the undecideds.
Well, I always, you know, found that to be a little bit of a joke, you know.
But that is the large thing that both of those parties are going for are those votes.
Well, look
right
at,
there.
Right, look at the 2014 elections. I mean, in fact, this has been a trend for now, but I think it really came out 2 years ago, is that the largest voting bloc out there now are those people who don't vote.
Right.
And then you've got to people who do vote. I think there's a slight majority of those who consider themselves independents as opposed to Democrats or Republicans.
It's actually a solid majority amongst younger people too. Ages 20 to 35, 50% of them say, I'm independent. You can keep both of your major parties. And that'll be a large part of my campaign is, getting out and touching those people and letting them know that I'm here and I understand the concerns that they're expressing.
Okay.
You know, I think that a lot of the problem has been that people just haven't had a choice. You know, we've been limited to these two parties and you see, and it's difficult. The parties, they've been having a lot of fun for a long time, the people at the highest levels and their funders.
Mm-hmm.
And they do their damnedest to keep anybody else from getting on the ballot. For instance, one of the biggest impediments to my running is simply getting on the ballot. I need 11,000 to 17,000 signatures.
Wow.
Whereas if I was a Democrat or a Republican, I would need about 1,000. And so it's, they don't want anybody raining on their parade and they make it difficult. You know, people wind up just holding their noses and voting for what they think is the lesser of two evils rather than proudly casting a vote for someone who believes in the things they believe in.
Now, of course, in addition to that, the national level, there's the exclusion of anybody who's not a Democrat or Republican from televised debates.
Oh,
so people don't even know they exist.
Right.
Now, in Illinois, last time at least, there was three of you running and all three got their equal airtime on the debates, so this will happen this time, I'm hoping.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have to demonstrate some strength through polling. They locked out John Hartman last time.
Your performances in these previous elections, I think, should guarantee you a position on the stage.
Well, I'd be surprised if we have difficulty with that, you know, but the first campaign for me, frankly, is getting on the ballot. We start collecting signatures in late March and we've got 90 days.
90 days?
Yeah, 90 days to get those.
Wow.
We need we're aiming for a couple hundred signatures a day for 90 days. So, we are ramping up, but we've been busy for months putting the infrastructure of the campaign together and gathering up volunteers, to get that done.
Okay. So David, I kind of begs the question. It's like, why are you doing this again? I mean, you know, it's like, man, I mean, you know, let's put it this way. I'm glad you are. Don't get me wrong, but sure. It's just like, wow. I mean, this is a lot of work and effort and, tell us why you're doing this.
Well, I think it's born of the frustration of seeing my fellow man suffer. You know, I went into medicine because I care about my fellow man and woman. And it's that same motivation that drives me to do this. And to see a country with so much in the way of resources cheat the vast majority of its people out of retirement security, access to appropriate education at all age levels, healthcare security, which is really what spurred me a long time ago to get into this whole thing. It's employment security. The list goes on and on. And I just can't sit back and stomach it. And to know that I've built something, you know, those three previous campaigns back in 04, 06, and 2010 that ultimately, you know, got me nowhere. They did establish a base and they established a brand, if you will, to where those 15 to 20% of Republicans say, hey, that guy's speaking truth. I like what he has to say. I work a lot in Ford County, a 90% Republican district, and I'll meet patients and introduce myself when I go in to see them in the ER, and they'll say, oh, are you that, David Gill? I really liked what you had to say. I just wish you didn't have that D after your name. So, I'm in a position now, having run those previous campaigns, where I can pull this off, and I sense a desperate need for the growth of an independent movement here in this country, and we can be a spearhead to that right here in Illinois 13, and to watch people sit back and accept this so-called healthcare reform that was written by one of the big insurance companies, WellPoint, you know, and pushed off onto us as something meaningful, mm-hmm. and a dramatic change, to watch these trade policies that we've seen, and the Trans-Pacific Partnership coming up, and to see my Democratic Party pushing that, it turns my stomach, and I'm really, it's very freeing to run as an independent and to really let folks know what I think.
Okay, very good. Gus, did you have any questions, for David or?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely, like I said, I appreciate the fact that you're taking this opportunity to really educate people about the dangers and the pitfalls of the two-party system, when in fact pushing a progressive agenda to do something about one of the biggest issues facing Americans today, which is healthcare, which I argue is a human rights crisis. And I don't know how the UN has not stepped in to say something about the fact that that people here are not guaranteed health in this country. But, it's really interesting. So, and it really shows when you look at debates, we're going to talk about this, after the commercial as well. Mm-hmm. When you look at the debate on, Thursday night, and you see just the lack of clarity and the dodging of questions and the gall of the candidates for the Democratic Party to basically just upend each other and not really address the issues that are, I mean, Anderson Cooper was asking very specific questions and not one of them was ever answered. No. And so this goes into, and you brought up a very excellent point about how these parties have had so much fun for so much time now. They've been able to get away with that ambiguity for so long now, that because it's rooted in the way they were created back when the Federalists and the Republicans were the first political parties, and they literally shut out everybody else that mm-hmm. was not a part of their ideologies. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is dangerous stuff. And until we have individuals like you who actually stand up in their respective areas and challenge these people, challenge the Democrats, challenge the Republicans to actually do something and not talk a bunch of mess, then, I mean, we're going to be in the same situation. So again, I think that one of the best things that you're doing is you're raising the awareness of the people. So my question is, when you do go, when you speak to other people and you talk about these issues with Democratic Republican Party, do you see kind of an upsurge of young people trying to do what you're doing? Not, I mean, you know, and talk about the 50% that vote independent. Mm-hmm. What about the percentage of youth who want to get into politics and not be a part of a party and run independent? What do you see with that in the future?
I think that it's growing. You know, I see an increased passion out there, and I think people appreciate the clarity that an independent brings. You're right. And I'm not ambiguous. I tell people what I think, mm-hmm. and it's regardless of what audience I'm talking to. And I think that's why that 15 to 20% of Republicans appreciate me. They might, again, they might disagree with what they're hearing, but they're like, he's actually telling me what he thinks. He's not dancing around things. And young people especially, you know, young people are really smart in this. They're much smarter than when I was young. And, they recognize everybody in America has been getting the short end of the stick, but especially the youth in this country, you know, being sent off to these endless wars, being asked to pay outrageous sums for their education, and then getting done with school and not being able to find jobs. And they feel so cheated. And, yeah, I think they're very passionate about getting involved in politics and stepping out of that two-party model because it has failed them miserably.
And you bring up a very good point that we're going to talk a lot about after the commercial as well, is that you said the Republicans, they respect you because you speak your mind like they do. Because that's one thing that people get really mixed up about this. The conservatives and the Republicans, they are very clear in what their agenda is. They don't sidestep. They say, we don't like these people. We want this money. We're going to do this. And too bad. I don't want these people around me. They say that very clear. Mm-hmm. The problem historically has been the liberals, the Democrats, who are trying to sidestep and talk this reform and not actually put forth an agenda like the stuff we saw in the debate last night. So again, people are trying to target the Republicans and conservatives. They're not the problem. We know where they stand. The problem is that these liberals try to co-opt so many different progressive movements and progressive campaigns that they're able to cloud the judgment of the masses. Yeah. That's who we really need to be making sure that we challenge. We don't have to challenge Republicans. We know they're racist and they're capitalists. We know what they're about. But these liberals who are masking their racism and their capitalist greed for being progressive, no, we got to call these people out. So I appreciate you bringing that point up.
Yeah, I just saw something interesting is that we need to stop talking so much about, you know, conservative, liberal, Democrat, Republican, and start talking in terms of from the bottom up. And then basically, you know,
I agree with you, David. I say we need to talk about, are you for people or not?
Yeah,
you
know, okay. And, real people.
And, yeah, exactly. Yeah, these other labels, I think they are tools that mm-hmm. Republicans and Democrats use to divide us.
Yes.
You know, we agree on much more when it comes to basic things in daily life and putting food on the table and a roof over your head. We agree on a lot more than we disagree on, but you know, you throw guns into the equation, you throw gay rights into the mm-hmm. equation. Not that those things are not important, but they use those as wedges, along yep. with language, conservative and liberal. They use those things to keep us sniping at each other, and then we take our eye off the ball and don't see that
yep.
they're all selling themselves out to just Wall
like
Street banks.
A con man with on the corner with exactly. three cups and one ball, you know, watch my, you know, and distract you, and yep, that's what's been the two-party shell game.
Well, let me tell you something else, too. Yeah. I really wish that the American unions would give their members a real political education rather than just say vote for Democrats.
Yeah.
Or your union's going away.
And yeah. and a vote from the rank yeah. and file of who the union should endorse, as opposed to these top-down decisions like we saw with Randy Weingarten of the American Federation of Teachers and some other unions that said, well, we're going to endorse Hillary Clinton. Well, gee, what do your members think?
Well, I mean, it's like I tell you about people that I work with in the building trades, and they just had, like, the guy I was talking to this week who was 8% flat tax with no deductions. I mean, that's just ridiculous. You know, where's he getting this? The other day he told me, well, you know, they're probably, if they ban assault weapons, you know, they can also ban the ammunition. But he said, I'm really happy because I do have a gun that shoots 9mm and it's so popular they'll never ban 9mm, you know, ammunition. And part of that is people get into these guns and all news related to guns is right wing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All the way far out to the farthest stretches of right wing. Anything having to do with guns, mm-hmm. any media.
Yeah.
And the unions really need to counteract this stuff.
Yeah. You know? Okay. Well, David, thank you so much for coming on the World Labor Hour. And, I'd like to get you in here again as your campaign starts sure. heating up here.
And by the way, yes. I'm not being so anti-gun. It's just that this whole gun culture is being a real problem.
Yeah.
You know, politically.
We have a real polarization there, that's for yeah. sure. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back. You listen to the World Labor Hour on Listen Supporting Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. Stay tuned.
the people are tired of a government that has no clue. What's trash? Inside fighting between the red and the blue. Political corruption, sex scandals out of control. The people are tired of cash. Wage and cash divorce, the people want to change. Tired of the same old. They can't wait for the polls to open. Down with the status quo. Country going through recession. Jobs are on the line. Kids can't afford college. The bills are so far behind. Sheep's got a headlock on us. Gas is on the rise. Can't afford to use my dollar. It's like the people want to change. Tired of the same old thing. They can't wait for the cold to open. Down with the stand. To be rented, bury me like a mummy when I die. The people want to change. Tired of the same old thing. They can't wait for the cold to open. Down with the status quo.
Okay, that was John Lee Hooker singing "People Want to Change." I just had to play that song for you, David. And David Gill said he could stick around. I thought he had to go somewhere, so he's going to hang out with us for a little bit longer. So we're really glad to hear that, to really join him today. Real quick public service announcement. Tune in this Sunday and every Sunday for Labor's Worldview TV from 4 to 5 p.m. on Urbana Public Television at Comcast Channel 6 and webcast live worldwide at www.urbanapublictelevision.org. This Sunday, part one of the healthcare movie. Actually, I take that back. That's the whole healthcare movie, edited down to 60 minutes. It's a film made by a couple, an American and a Canadian, who are basically do interviews with people on the streets in Seattle, Washington, and across the border in Canada in Vancouver, British Columbia, talking about and comparing, contrasting the Canadian single-payer healthcare system and the U.S. corporate healthcare system. And it's quite a revealing movie about, I mean, some of these, I mean, it's really well done. I mean, you get a lot of people's opinions, and not only that, but a lot of statistics that are really, wow. I mean, lots of stuff. I mean, everything from unnecessary deaths in the U.S. because people don't have access to health care every year, the number of people that have to declare bankruptcy because of medical debt. And then they compare it to Canada. Number of people who die in the United States from, lack of access to health care, and it's like 50,000 some. Number who die in Canada, zero. Number of people declare bankruptcy in the United States, over a million every year. The number in Canada, zero. Real good film. Really, really well done. So I really highly recommend it. So tune into that tomorrow from 4 to 5 p.m. on Urbana Public Television, Comcast Channel 6. Okay, so I think, Gus, there was something interesting that happened last week, I guess. You call it interesting. Democratic presidential debates.
Oh, yeah. Those Democrats, those liberals coming out doing their thing, man. It was quite a show, really. For those that watched the debate, you saw Bernie Sanders give an amazing definition of what socialism is to the people. I mean, it was really like up there. It was something he was very honest about. He said, and I quote, well, when you're going to win, because first we're going to explain what democratic socialism is, and what it is about saying that it is immoral and wrong, and that the top 0.1% in this country owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. That is wrong today in a rigged economy, that 57% of all new income is going to the top 1%. So again, I mean, he's going into some really good stuff there that talks about how socialism works. But the major problem with Bernie Sanders is his just lack of intense reaction to Hillary Clinton and other corporate Democrats. We all know that Hillary Clinton is actually a corporate Democrat, mm-hmm. who actually is on the board of Walmart. I mean, she's trying to make, say all this stuff about, well, you know, I support the small business, man. No, you don't, because you run with an organization, a monstrous entity known as Walmart that actually destroys small businesses. So she's telling all these things about, you know, trying to change her appeal that she's so for the people and she's so about helping all the smaller businesses out, that there's a good capitalist versus a bad capitalist and all this stuff. The first thing is, Hillary Clinton, as we know, is a liar. There's nothing you can do or say that can, I mean, I don't know the last time she told the truth, to be honest with you. I mean, seriously, going back to when her husband was president, I mean, everything that comes out of the Clinton's mouths are lies. The second thing is this: trying to divide this idea of a good capitalist versus bad capitalist. By doing this, you're miseducating the people about how capitalism works. It has nothing to do with personal greed. Capitalism as a system exists off the basis of profit. Profit has to come from the exploitation of labor, regardless of what type of business it is. In American capitalism, if you don't make a profit, your business collapses. And the only way to make profit is to exploit labor. So what Hillary Clinton is doing this, and Bernie Sanders did this as well, as saying about good capitalists versus bad capitalists, they're individualizing how capitalism works, and that if you get rid of some greedy people, that capitalism will actually get better and people will actually have more of a chance to succeed. That's not how this works.
I just interrupted. You know, capitalism, I mean, let's define capitalism, because when we say capitalism, are we talking about the exchange of goods and services that existed since before the dawn of civilization?
Or are we talking about concentrated wealth
through the form of either individuals, but more importantly, corporations that control not only our economy, but also our elected government and even our culture?
Well, yeah, let's make sure.
I mean, that's my definition.
No, you're right, and I agree with you, but let's periodize this though correctly, yeah. Because a lot of people think capitalism is just this homogenous system that we've always had. But let's not forget that capitalism was created with the onset of the transatlantic slave trade, and also the creation of the so-called New World in quotation marks by the Europeans as they expanded out to the Western Hemisphere.
European elites and the aristocracy
were the only ones that could afford to sail. I mean, the ones that borrowed money from the companies that paid for it. Yeah. So you start off with mercantile capitalism or commerce capitalism. Mm-hmm. Then it shifts. It shifts because of the ending of the slave trade in 1808 to agricultural capitalism being the dominant mode of production. Mm-hmm. So you have plantation systems and king cotton dominating global markets.
Then, and before and during that too, you also had these monopolies, these corporate monopolies like the East Indian Trading Company, the Hudson Bay.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, the American Revolution was conducted against a corporation.
That's right.
More or less. And by the way, this is Merriam-Webster, and this reflects all the things that you were talking about. An economic system characterized by private or corporate ownership of capital goods, by investments that are determined by private decision, and by prices, production, and distribution of goods that are determined mainly by competition. And here's where I really disagree with something. In a free market, it's not really a free market. But see, nothing in that definition disallows monopolies or anything else. The only thing that would be close would be free market.
Or rigged trade agreements that basically dictate terms to country sovereignty and the people's democracy, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and before that, even NAFTA.
Exactly, and that's the thing. When you shift from agricultural capitalism after the fall of plantation society to industrial revolution to industrial capitalism, it started earlier in Europe, in the early 1830s, but moved into the 1890s in America. Mm-hmm. Then you see the shift from unfree labor to free labor, from unfree labor to free labor, and the wages now are part of the working class system. But again, they're being exploited for the profit of the factory owners. Again, it doesn't matter if the person is really good at heart. The fact that they own the means of production, they're getting a profit, which is not being given to the people, and they're making not what they're worth or what they're producing. That's what I consider to be a human rights violation. That's wrong. Then it shifted in the 1970s again when the industrialization left the country to go overseas, when the neoliberal...
To get cheap labor.
Exactly. To get even cheaper labor, when the neoliberal theorists actually created this idea of neoliberalization. That process that actually made private ownership more restricted. Because that's what neoliberalism is, y'all. It's when you take private ownership from earlier forms of capitalism and you actually restrict it even tighter from other groups. And then used to do that by spreading it overseas to different areas for cheaper labor. And so that's where we're at right now, is the fact that we have to start educating how capitalism works, because they had a lot of things to talk about in the debate Thursday night about capitalism, but they never once fully defined it and how it affects people. They just said, Hillary said, we need to save capitalism from itself. No, we don't. The reason why so many people are suffering, and the fact that you have to pay money to get asthma medicine that you cannot afford when you were born with the disease, you know, is that because of capitalism. So, I mean, how is that not a violation of human rights? Because they're, because the corporations are making profit off of illness of humans. That's wrong.
Well, yes. Okay, I'd like to get back to this definitional thing where a lot of things have been really abused probably over the last 10 years or so, such as the word socialism. And a lot of this has happened on the right. All of a sudden, they found out that Nazi stands for National Socialist Workers Party, a party that was neither socialist or for workers. It was just used because socialist, those two terms are really popular at the time.
Correct.
And I'm tired of socialists being called Nazis because of that. That just shows the shallowness and the lack of historical knowledge of conservative people. Now, I got something right here, Dave, that you can pop up on auxiliary, which is Donald Trump. Just here's what he interprets Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton saying in that debate.
Okay.
Okay.
Auxiliary's on, so.
Right, and this is from the Young Turks.
Okay.
She's the poor woman. She's got to give everything away because this maniac that was standing on her right is giving everything away, so she's following. That's what's happening. This socialist slash communist, okay, nobody wants to say it. And nobody's heard the term communist. But you know what? I call him a socialist slash communist, okay, because that's what he is.
I call him a socialist slash communist because I don't know what either one of those mean. It just sounds bad.
Now, Bernie Sanders explained very carefully what a democratic socialist is.
Yeah.
And Trump is like, that those facts are irrelevant.
Yeah. Okay. And just to add on to what, and just to add on what Bill was saying, what's really funny is the ignorance in a lot of people that are equating the Nazi party with socialists when Hitler was a virulent anti-socialist. He went after communists and any left-wing groups with just fierce vengeance.
They were one of the first ones to go.
Yeah,
and then the trade unions. And,
of course,
I mean, it took a while for them to actually get around to Jewish people. Really.
Exactly, the Nazi Party by definition was anti-socialist, anti-communist. So when people try to equate that, you know, that's when you don't even argue with people who are being illogical because they they need to go
but
read.
Back to the debates. While we got a few minutes here, so to say. The least, I mean, you thought it was a little shallow?
Yeah, it was incredibly shallow because for two reasons. Number one, they dodged a lot of questions that they did not want to answer. I mean, things like where Anderson Cooper said, what would you do to end racism in America? And then, of course, that, well, institutional racism is a major problem in America that we have to struggle. And then people would clap and that would be it. I mean, that's their answers to everything. And again, I understand they're doing that because they don't want to be accountable for their answers if they actually have to get in office and do a policy. But the fact that we're applauding this and not booing it, throwing tomatoes at this, is a travesty in American politics. It's a joke. And Bernie Sanders' passive aggressive behavior towards Hillary Clinton, cussing at her and then giving her a handshake, his biggest applause of the night was defending Hillary Clinton. That's how you know he lost. Yeah,
we're sick of your email.
And that was his biggest applause of the night. That's how you know Bernie Sanders is going to lose his nomination, because he is too in bed and soft on the corporate Democrats. He needs to attack them. How are you going to talk bad about capitalism and not attack the main capitalist on the stage? I mean, it's just utterly doesn't make any sense, especially when you're trailing in the polls. And that's why the Democratic Party, first of all, needs to be abolished, but we need actual progressive candidates and progressive people to run for these political parties that are going to not only attack systems, but attack people that uphold these systems. Because Hillary Clinton should have been crying by the end of that debate when Bernie Sanders was talking to her.
Instead of her usual smug smile.
And laughing and hugging him.
Yeah. I agree with you, Gus, because you know what? Right now, I am a voter, but like, I'm confused because okay, who am I going to vote for, and are they actually going to be for us?
And it actually represents your interests.
Sure.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, right now. You can tell me anything on television, but what are you really about? So, therefore, this is a problem for people that don't vote.
Oh, indeed, indeed. Yeah. And David, what was your take? Did you have to watch the debates? Or
yeah, I saw bits and pieces of it, and yeah, I thought it was very shallow, and I agree with Gus. They were very transparent, evasive, not making it clear where they really stand on things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I found it interesting. The one thing it seemed like they attacked, or when Hillary Clinton and O'Malley went on the offensive, it seemed like it was always identity politics issues, in particular the gun control thing.
Oh, of course, I mean, and that's
of course they wouldn't address what the real root cause of the gun violence in the United States is.
Like I said, they're going to play extremely safe. There's no way that a Democrat is going to call out the structural problem in America. I mean, again, and even if you look at Bernie Sanders' answers, he didn't necessarily call out capitalism. He tried to divide it and individualize it in good capitalism versus bad capitalism. So again, he's not going to call out the foundational structural constraints that's causing a lot of problems for poverty and other issues like racism in America.
Gus, do you think it would have been different if he ran as an independent? And he succeed?
He wouldn't have been on the stage, of course.
Right, yeah.
But I mean, the thing about Bernie Sanders is, and again, I don't think he would have succeeded as an independent anyway because the media, they shut these people out who are actually very good, public servants, but.
Well, he says that his major reason for staying within the party on this is so that he can retain his, position in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the caucus and his committee
chiefs
and all of that.
He's an independent. He's like one of two independent members.
He caucuses with the Democrats.
True, yes.
Yeah, so like I said, I don't really believe that he would have been successful if he was independent because the media, like I said, they would have shut him out. But the main problem I see with Bernie Sanders is that he's pushing a reform agenda, and he says the word revolution, but everything that he says is reform.
Yeah.
And if you're a socialist, then reform is not part of your platform.
I tell you, I've been kind of really conflicted about the Bernie Sanders campaign for a while now, but one thing that kind of, you know, gives me a little hope, and I'm saying a little, okay, is how many people have just come out of the woodwork to support him. I mean, he's been getting these huge rallies of people. I mean, he's touched onto something. He's hit something out there. And so people's expectations they're getting excited and they're getting hopeful. And, I'm just wondering, if Hillary Clinton wins the nomination, how this dynamic's going to play out. I'm just kind of waiting to see what's going to happen.
And let's talk about that because I think that's important to recognize is that not only has he raised the consciousness of the people about working class struggles in just the things he's been saying, but you notice that Hillary Clinton's rhetoric has also shifted somewhat to working class leftist issues that she would have never touched on if not for Bernie Sanders. Even though I don't call it a push, he was more so tapping her to do it.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, I think that's important though. And I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think there's any chance of Hillary losing the nomination, especially based off of that debate. I mean, Sanders has one chance to actually attack her for her policies when her husband was president and all her stuff that she had that happened when she was Secretary of State.
And Senate.
He left it alone. So I don't see him actually doing anything past that. But if Hillary does, well, when she does win the nomination, something major can really happen when the people, if they continue.
If they see there's a choice between Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton, I mean, wow, what a choice, huh?
I mean, let's be honest. I think Jeb kind of put himself out of the race with that comment about, you know, stuff happens after the Oregon shooting. Yeah, they're crucifying him about
for
that.
For now, but let's see what happens. But David, any last words on this?
Bernie has pushed, Hillary a little bit. You know, now she's against the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
Well, before she wouldn't take a stand.
Yeah. I don't take any of that seriously.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay, very good. Well, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on the supported community radio station WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Dave, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
We'll get you back on the show here when your campaign starts heating up because I imagine it's going to be a real interesting campaign to say the least and hopefully successful. And tune in after the World Labor Hour for the Union Edge. And until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.